My name is Sue Fennell, and it's my pleasure this morning both to welcome you and also Cheryl Gray, who's going to be our guest speaker this morning, and thank her very much for travelling all the way out here. Cheryl's a US national, and she assumed her current position in the independence director of the Independent Evaluation Group in the World Bank in November 2007. She manages approximately 85 staff and a large group of consultants whose role is to evaluate the development of effectiveness of World Bank projects and programs. IEG is independent, reports directly to the World Bank Board of Executive Directors. For those of you who haven't actually ever been to the IEG website, it's worth a look. There's lots of interesting publications there that, you know, whilst they've been developed many cases specifically for development evaluation, also have much wider applications. So I can commend you having a look at those publications. Ms. Gray joined the bank in 1986 after receiving a PhD and a JD from Harvard University and working 3 years with the Ministry of Finance in Indonesia. Prior to her current assignment, she served as Director, Poverty Reduction and Economic Management in the Bank's Europe and Central Asia, ECA, Vice Presidency. And I'd like you to welcome Cheryl this morning. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I'm really very pleased to be here. My last trip to Australia was 27 years ago, so things have changed, and it's really wonderful to be back. I must say I have tremendous respect for this part of the world. One thing that was not mentioned, before I worked on Europe, Central Asia, for 5 years I was the director for public sector reform in the World Bank, and Australia and New Zealand were both really two of the models of good government that we used. And even now, if you go to other parts of the world where the World Bank works, you'll see a lot of influence of New Zealand and Australia in the models of government that they have here. Including many good colleagues. Our former president, Jim Wolfensohn, of course, was born in Australia. I don't know if you all know Martin Revalian, who's one of the most well-known economists, frankly, in the world, and working on impact evaluation, what I'll talk about. He's also from Australia. And then I have many good friends from New Zealand and Australia, and we draw on their expertise and their knowledge of government, frankly, and how it works well. I know if you're here, you probably are saying, as Americans always do, oh, there's so many problems with my government. But I can tell you from the rest of the world, Australia and New Zealand look pretty good. Even, frankly, from the United States, the way, and even being here, I've been so impressed with the signs up. I took the boat in Sydney, and you know, they had all the performance measures out there for the public to see on on-time performance and number of complaints and all this, just, you know, trying to have a performance-oriented culture in the public service, so that was great. I wanted to talk today about the evaluation of international development programs, which is, of course, what the World Bank does. I think this is a hugely important field. It's somewhat different than the nuts and bolts of evaluation in an advanced society here or in the United States, but it's really very critical. I don't have to tell you all that poverty is still one of the huge challenges facing our world. I would highly recommend, if you haven't read it, the book The Bottom Billion by Paul Collier, which really puts into perspective how the poorest live. And this is a billion people that live on less than $1 a day. And of course, there are several other billions that live on $2 a day or less. For most of these, they live in governments that are not like, in countries with governments not like, needless to say, Australia or New Zealand, countries that really have a hard time having governments that perform in the public interest and that can measure and evaluate performance. So I think all of us working in development have a tremendous responsibility, really, to the world and the citizens of the world to help these countries develop this expertise and develop good government, which we're fortunate enough to have ourselves. Many questions are being raised about the effectiveness of development aid. You all have probably heard some of these names. Jeff Sachs, of course, Bono, who have been saying, you're not doing enough. On the other side, you have Bill Easterly, who's actually a dear friend of mine that joined the World Bank at the same time. I'm quite critical of him right now, but he is a good friend. And a new book, Dead Aid by Dambisa Moyo from Zambia, criticizing as complete waste of money, or worse, the development aid. So those are kind of two sides of the argument. And then there's, of course, a large group in between. But certainly it's risen to the fore, the debate over the effectiveness of development aid. In fact, one of the shocks I had was my daughter went off to college and came back after the first semester, having studied some of these, and asked me, why do you work for that organization? So I can tell you, at least in academia in the United States, the critiques of development aid are alive and well and getting a huge amount of voice and a huge hearing. So we need guidance and we need answers, and we all need to learn as much as we can to be as effective as we possibly can. It is also true, as yesterday, of course, there was a lot of discussion of evidence-based policy. This is also in RCTs and impact evaluation. This has also very much entered the world of development evaluation. There's a big push. A few years ago, the Center for Global Development, which was started actually by a former World Bank staff member, published a book, When Will We Ever Learn? And it was a very strong negative critique of development evaluation, as if nothing had been learned, and when will we ever learn was the title of the book. And it was calling for much more rigorous impact evaluation against counterfactuals, not quite to the point of RCTs, but still very much along these lines. It has been picked up, a huge push now in academia in the United States to do, frankly, RCTs primarily, but other kinds of impact evaluation in developing countries, starting with the MIT Poverty Lab that has been set up and has gotten to be very well known, but also moving now to Yale has something similar. Most of the Berkeley, you know, has something similar. Most of the, I have heard that half of the PhDs in economics right now in the United States are doing impact evaluations in developing countries, which is phenomenal, just an unbelievable change. 10 years ago or 20 years ago when I studied, a little more than 20 years ago, there was nothing in developing countries for PhD students in the United States. It was almost unheard of. Now, up to half of the PhD students are doing their PhD dissertations in developing countries, heavily using RCTs. So it's a huge change. I think a great change. I think the jury's still out as to whether this information, seeps through to real learning and changes, but certainly I think it's a great change to get that kind of talent focusing on these kinds of issues. So I think the evidence-based world has entered development aid and is affecting us all. And what I want to do today, that's just a fairly long introduction, is give you a sense, in a sense, of what IUG does and what I personally have learned. I've been there 2 years. As was mentioned, I was 10 years in research in the World Bank, so I had a strong background in research. And then I was 10 years on the operational side, actually making loans and working with clients. And then I came to IEG, not knowing evaluation, but having a good sense of the organization, where the bodies are buried, as I say, and of research methodology. So I've picked up a lot on evaluation, very, very interesting, and I'm learning. And I wanted to just share with you kind of some observations that I have had and what I think I might have learned over this period. Much of it I think you will already know, so bear with me. But, you know, things that can sound simple can also, the more you understand them, really actually be a bit more profound, and they're not always so simple. And these things have come to me in a sense much deeper than I would have thought before I had 2 years of experience doing this work. First, before I do that, I'll just give you a little sense of IEG for those of you who don't know. This is the layout of the bank's, in a sense, structure. The independent evaluation group, where I am, is about, it's three departments. Most, the largest is the World Bank, which I head. We also have an IFC, which is the private sector arm, and a very small group called MIGA, which does guarantees. And so there's IEG, IFC, IEG MIGA, and IEG World Bank. All of them together are IEG and report directly to the board, completely independent, really independent. And that's been a tremendous gratification for me when I came. Independent budget, no negotiations, you know, everything's independent. Hiring, your personnel policies. And we do report directly to the board. The only other entity that reports directly to the board is the inspection panel, which handles a very narrow set of complaints about the safeguards policies in environmental social safeguards of the World Bank. And they handle cases, it's like a tribunal. All the rest of the accountability and evaluation groups are part of World Bank management. And here I'll talk about self-evaluation. There are also what's called the Quality Assurance Group, which does evaluations during the course of projects. There's the Institutional Integrity, INT, which handles all corruption charges against clients or against bank staff. Internal audit, and we have an ombudsman. So there's a lot of different organizations. Most of them are part of management. IAG is separate from management. We have in IAG a whole range of activities. It's really in a pyramid, with project evaluations. The World Bank puts out about 250 to 300 projects per year. Last year, the fiscal year that just ended at the end of June, the World Bank Group lent almost $60 billion. So that's a significant increase given the financial crisis. But it's a lot of money going out the door. About $50 billion of that was through the World Bank, through approximately 250 or 300, discrete loans, projects or policy loans. Every one of those loans has a process where it has to have a monitoring and evaluation framework built into the loan. And at the end of the loan, when it closes, it's self-evaluated by the task team that did the project. Then it comes to IEG, and 100% of them we validate. We look at every one. About a quarter of the time, we go to the field and look at the project. So this is a very strong, procedure, process, to try to get monitoring and evaluation in World Bank projects. The thing that's very nice about it is IAG, since they know IAG is going to look at all of these, the task teams, are a little bit more careful to do it well. I think that's fair to say. Because the worst thing you can do as a manager in operations is to have what's called a disconnect with IAG, where you come along and say this is a successful project, and IAG goes out in the field and says it's not a successful project. That's much worse than having an unsuccessful project, which everybody knows some of these projects will be unsuccessful. But if there's a disagreement and you have a disconnect, it kind of hints that you may have, not been entirely honest. That's not always the case, of course. So task teams try very hard not to have disconnects. And I think that incentive is extremely valuable. It may be the best thing that IAG does, actually, is create the incentive for good self-evaluation. But so all of those project evaluations we have, we do that. That's, even though it's about 250 projects, it's still only 2 or 3% of our budget, actually, surprisingly enough, on this. Then we have the same kind of thing on country program evaluations. 20 to 30 per year of three-year country programs end each 3-4 years. They're self-evaluated by the regions, and then we also validate those, sometimes go to the field. Sometimes we do more in-depth country program evaluations, but that tends to be, most of them are of this type. And then we do, most of our money actually is spent on the larger evaluations, thematic sector evaluations, corporate evaluations, or evaluations of global programs. We do about, in the World Bank, about 15 to 20 of these per year, plus another 6 or 7 evaluations of global programs, which is growing in importance. The top one is just quick briefs that come off of all the rest. When the board wants to know something, we'll do a quick brief. But we build on that base of our very strong knowledge of the projects and of the country programs. Types of thematic sector, you can see it's all across the board. The reason I'm telling you this partly is you'll see when we get to evaluation, there's no way you could do RCTs on most of this work. It's just not conceivable. All across the board, every sector you can think of. This is a list of only about half of the evaluations that have been done over the last couple of years or are now in process. But it really covers the gamut. Now, I won't go into how we choose these, but we could talk about that in the questions if you want to. But I just wanted to give you a sense of the incredible variety of things that come across, frankly, my desk, which is one thing I love about this job. You really see the entire world, and you're learning all the time about a lot of sectors that, frankly, I didn't know much about before. So that's really a lot of fun. So to go on, I'd like to just summarize. I thought 10 is a magic number, so 10 observations. Again, please bear with me if they seem kind of simple, but in preparing for this, I started to think, what have I learned? What could I perhaps pass on from the experience that I've had? So I will give it a try. First, and starting from the beginning, because we're really starting from the beginning of an evaluation when you define the topic. Now, for many cases in evaluation world, the topic's given. You have a program, you have to evaluate it. But where we are, we really have wide latitude in how we define what we're going to evaluate. Other than the projects and the countries, the bottom layers, which are given, the big evaluations, we can basically decide what we want to evaluate. We're independent, it's up to us. We may take inputs from the board or from others. And it's really important to define the scope appropriately. It's a question of breadth versus depth. If you have too wide a topic, you really have trouble saying much that's very meaningful. It becomes somewhat shallow. On the other hand, and for example, to be honest, I'll give you some examples from our work. Maybe don't quote me on some of this, but we just did an evaluation of 20 years of environmental work in the World Bank. It's a very important topic. What's been the environmental footprint, or what's been the impact of our work? It was really very hard because it's such a huge topic. So many things touch environment. It was such a long time frame. It was the whole World Bank group, IFC, MIGA. We tried our best. We have to do all this in 100 pages because the board doesn't like anything more than 100 pages. Really tough to do satisfactorily. We also tried to do one on the World Bank's impact on decentralization in developing countries. Another huge topic. As we got into it, said this is just too big a topic to really give justice to. On the other hand, we've tried some very small topics. We just finished an impact evaluation type work on one agricultural irrigation project in Peru. It was just too small. It was one project. We spent $200,000 learning about how you might actually tweak this project a little bit to make it perform better. Not necessarily learning that could apply in any other country. Too small a project. So how you pick your topics, we really have to give a lot of thought to for it to get the biggest bang for the buck, in a sense, on the valuation. A few examples I put here where I think we've really done it right. How many in this room have heard of doing business? A few people? It's actually one of the biggest, most well-known outputs of the World Bank. They rate every country in the world on their investment climate. And it gets a whole lot of press. And a lot of developing countries are always trying to game the system to do better on doing business. And they have awards at the New York Stock Exchange and all of these wonderful things. It's a team that knows how to market their product. But there's a lot of distrust of doing business. And a lot of developing countries really don't like it, especially the ones that don't score very well. So we actually did an evaluation last year of doing business, and it was just the right size of a topic. We found, as we looked under the surface, a lot of methodological question marks about how this is put together, and we put them all out on the table. It was quite amazing, because nobody knew a lot of the things that we found. And yet we also realized the power of this. It's actually very powerful at getting countries to reform their business environment. We had 3 board meetings on that because it's such a controversial topic, and it really was very rigorous and yet relevant. Big enough topic, important enough topic to be relevant. We did one recently on guarantees in the World Bank group, and that was very, very powerful. And HNP, which is health, nutrition, population, one of the ones that got the most coverage, because it was really very critical, unfortunately, was of the World Bank's work on health, nutrition, and population. Now, you would think that would be too big a topic, and it might have been, except that we happen to have a very, very strong team who had looked at this topic for years in depth and could structure it and pull it together in a very meaningful way. And that has also had a lot of impact, because it really has been probably the biggest problem sector in the World Bank is the health, nutrition, population, which is, of course, extremely important sector for the world. And so it really struck a nerve, this evaluation, which was discussed at our board this spring. Second challenge, clarifying objectives. Evaluators really need to be explicit about the objectives and the standards of performance. Development is multidimensional. There are many, many things that matter. Economic growth, the lot of the very poorest, poverty reduction, environmental sustainability, gender. There's a lot of aspects of development that matter. And which one you're looking at and what you're evaluating, you really have to be very explicit. Because they can get mixed up if you're not very careful about what objectives you're measuring. There's also, in terms of causing growth or causing poverty, what matters for development. There have been fads over the years. In the 70s, it was all about investment. In the 80s, it was all about international trade and opening your borders, export-led growth. Then it became all about education. And then in the 90s, governance. It was all about governance. And most recently, it's all about infrastructure. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but still, there are fads in development that you see rising and falling as you go on. In fact, there was a growth commission the World Bank funded just a couple of years ago. Of some of the world's Nobel Prize winners came together. What really leads to economic growth? And what they came up with is it depends. It depends on the context. It depends on the binding constraint in that environment at that point. None of these things, whether it's governance or infrastructure or education, were necessarily the key in all countries at all times. Perhaps not surprising, but the fact is you need to pull out these things and be very explicit about the model. And sometimes these are conflicting objectives. I mentioned here the last part. We're doing right now two evaluations that in a sense are conflicting. One is CBA cost-benefit analysis. We're actually looking at the extent to which cost-benefit analysis is being used in the design of bank projects. Because I think we would all agree you want to get the most benefit for your investment. So the traditional cost-benefit analysis makes sense. It's in the guidelines. The World Bank project should do this. We're asking, how many are actually doing it? Because our evidence is it's fallen down dramatically. But the implicit message there is this is what matters, is to get the design that will get the most benefit. On the other hand, we're looking at PRSCs. Some of you may know that terminology. It's Poverty Reduction Support Credits, which is pooled funding that goes to governments once a year, typically, that they can use as they want, and donors will pool into one fund. This is a whole different form of aid based very much on the idea of empowering the country to make its own decisions, getting away from conditionality, having donors collaborate with each other along the lines of the Paris Declaration, for those of you who know that. But there the objective is really process as much as end result. Very different mindset from the World Bank has to use cost-benefit analysis in every one of its projects. You can see different evaluators were doing these at the same time, and I'm very aware where I sit of the tension in these objectives. And so we really must be very explicit on clarifying our objectives. Third, here deciding what to measure. And here we're back to the question of outputs, outcomes, impacts. What are you actually measuring? I think we all agree, as was discussed yesterday, that the impact against a counterfactual is the ideal, what you would like to measure. But I can tell you in reality, and for those of you who work in development, even being able to measure outcomes is often a huge achievement. It's very hard to get even our task teams in the World Bank to really try to measure outcomes. In fact, we actually, in every time we review a project, we grade the evaluation, the self-evaluation, and the monitoring evaluation framework, and only 2/5 of our projects this past year were satisfactory monitoring and evaluation. Now, we have very high standards, I must say. We have a high bar. But one of the things is, have you measured outcomes? Not just the outputs, you know, how many schools you built or how many students were enrolled, but learning outcomes, what was actually achieved. So far, only 2/5 of our projects even measure it, much less constructing a counterfactual and trying to think of what would have happened without the project. So we are struggling very much in trying to get basics and basic data. I don't have to tell you all that very strong forces work against results measurement. One is the data is often very poor, the technical problems. Also, the politics. Task team leaders don't particularly want their projects to fail. Neither do their managers, neither do our clients. It's not easy to get people to measure outcomes, honestly, and put them down on paper. I mentioned the environment evaluation. One of the problems we have in the World Bank is it's not required to measure the environmental impact of a project unless it is classified as an environment project, which is a very small number of projects. So all of the transport projects in the bank, all of the water projects, it's not required to measure the environmental impact or the environmental outcomes. So we don't know. The fact is we don't know the environmental impact of the World Bank, which is a bit surprising given how many years we've been at this business. But it was not required. You had to measure how many kilometers of road was built or how much water was delivered. But in terms of the environmental outcomes, it wasn't required. Health and water, when we did the health evaluation, we found that all of the water projects didn't measure health outcomes, even though one of the most important thing for health is clean water. Unless they had a very explicit objective, which only a very small percentage did, no water project measured the health outcomes. So you can see the struggle of getting people and teams to put down outcomes. Now, ideally, you'd go further. And we are trying to support building into projects early on good impact evaluation. Rarely is it with RCTs. RCTs are very rarely applicable, partly because our projects are often projects where there's no counterfactual. You know, it might be a trade reform, it might be a public sector reform, it might be an environmental project where you really can't construct the counterfactual. Are certainly not a control group. We have all kinds of issues with control groups. But still, the World Bank is trying, just like academia is, to get more rigorous, build into its projects some good counterfactual measures, some good impact evaluation. We've actually gotten, the World Bank's gotten some money, quite a large trust fund from the Spanish government and from other sources to do more impact evaluation, build it into their projects, which is all for the good. So I'm not against it, I'm just saying, let's be realistic. The first step is just measure the outcomes. And then let's try to push harder and see if we can actually measure the impacts. I have to keep repeating, IUG tends to come in at the end. So the key is to get the incentives to get the project teams to build this in from the very beginning. One thing we're going to do next year is we're going to evaluate the impact evaluation work in the World Bank. We're going to try to do a meta-analysis, point out who's done it really well. We actually give awards every year. We have the IEG awards for the best monitoring evaluation, the best project, the best piece of analytic work. So we try also to give carrots as well as sticks to set the incentives that the staff in the World Bank take all this seriously, which is frankly probably our biggest impact rather than the evaluations we do. Fourth, on collecting evidence. Since the topic of the conference here is evidence, even though I haven't focused on that so much, it does come up here. We take whatever evidence we can find. We're not picky. We often have, it's often very imperfect. It's many sources, and we try to triangulate across different sources of evidence. Many sources can add value if done rigorously. We're doing a gender evaluation. I think this is a very important, interesting evaluation that will come out this fall. For that, we've done a portfolio review. We've looked at all of the bank's projects, a sample of them. How do they incorporate gender concerns? We took a random sample of 12 countries, went to the country, and looked in detail at the impact of the bank's work on gender. We reviewed all the country strategies. We did focus groups. We did surveys of the task team leaders and also of our clients. So we try to put together various sources of evidence and triangulate across those sources to try to get a meaningful case that really holds, is credible. And generally, over the last 2 years that I've been in this job, most people don't challenge the findings of IUG evaluations. We really try very hard to do a quality work. The typical response of management is, yes, we knew that, and we've already started to fix it, or we're already fixing it. But rarely will they come back and say, no, they got it wrong. So it's an eclectic mix. I definitely would say I'm in the, IEG is in the pragmatist camp that Professor Tolkien talked about yesterday. We'll grab whatever we can get, try and get it across different sources of evidence. I might say here also, it's really very important for donors to support data production and data collection. One of the best things you can do is help developing countries get better data. The LSMS, which is the Living Standards Measurement Survey that the World Bank started about 20 years ago, has now really become the basic household survey instrument to measure consumption and measure poverty. The CPIA is the Country Policy and Institutional Assessment, which ranks countries and measures countries' policy environments. And all that is public, it's all on the web, and it's used very widely. The investment climate surveys I had mentioned. Many types of data. Actually, the World Bank, with support from bilaterals, has a very large program on statistical capacity building. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars trying to help developing countries improve their statistical capacity building, which is also, of course, critical for evaluation. So collecting evidence and making data available is certainly very critical, but as I say, There's no hard and fast rules. Okay. Whatever you choose, it's obvious you have to ensure the quality of evidence, and easy to make mistakes here. And then that undermines your credibility from day one. Absolute research methods and good rigor, however you go about it, is very, very critical. I found, for example, when we came, IEG had been doing a survey of bank staff and how much they know IEG products, but they had only chosen as respondents the people that had been directly sent an IEG report. And then the question was, have you seen an IEG report? Well, of course, it was 60-70%. You'd think it would be 100, but it was still only 60-70. But a completely biased sample of respondents, because they were generalizing then to all World Bank staff. So we've revamped that, and I think this year we're doing it for all World Bank staff, a random sample. It's going to go way, way down as to how many people know IEG reports. So also when we're choosing countries for case studies, it's very tempting. We're doing an evaluation now of the World Bank's work on the financial crisis. It's very tempting to choose the countries that the World Bank's been very engaged in. You know, Indonesia, they gave $5 billion loan, or Hungary, or Romania. Let's go to those countries where we had a lot of activity and see what happened. Trouble is, you're answering the question by choosing a biased sample of countries. And really what you need to do is take all countries that have been affected by the financial crisis and do some kind of random sample and ask, did the World Bank get engaged in that country? And if not, why not? And if so, what did it do? So it's a multi-stage sampling, but we really have to be very, very careful. And there are mistakes so easy to make. I mean, I see it every day of choosing biased samples, and you really have to be careful on that. Also having low response rates. Some of our surveys, if you send them out, you know, people will say, I'll send out 1,000 requests, and if I get 200, I'll be happy, because 200 is a big number. But 200 is only 20%, and you really can't say much with a 20% response rate. You've really got to get it up to at least 50%. So we, every day, we face problems like this, and we have to be very, very careful and very rigorous on the quality of our evidence. Neglecting trade-offs, I put here, because another problem I find is when you evaluate something for a year or two, you become an advocate. And it's very hard to get our evaluators to not become advocates. We're doing an evaluation of water, and it's very hard. This person believes so much in the importance of water. We all do, but still, we're doing one on agriculture, and the person, you've got to do more work in agriculture. We're not doing enough in agriculture. We're not doing enough in water. We're not doing enough in health. We're not doing enough in environment. The trouble is, the World Bank can't increase every one of these, obviously. There are trade-offs. And so the evaluator must sit back and not become an advocate. And that's very hard to do when they've invested a year or two of their lives in this topic. Sixth, attributing causation is probably the most difficult challenge we face. And many of our, just simply the way we do development is making this even harder. On country evaluations, an example, we just evaluated our country program in the country of Georgia. Well, Georgia went through various phases. It had a Shevardnadze phase where everything went bad. It was terrible, no growth, bad policies. And then they switched and had this Rose Revolution to Saakashvili, who suddenly turned everything around. Now, you may not like some of his democratic principles if you've been reading the paper, but the fact is they had an unbelievable reform program. Incredible. And immediate response of economic growth, poverty reduction. Suddenly the fiscal accounts got in order. It was just phenomenal change in about 2 years. Well, the World Bank supported all of this with lending, but the last thing I would say is that the World Bank caused this. It was clearly the new government and their, you know, very strong reform commitment. And yet, if you do our typical evaluation, you will say, well, the World Bank program was successful. So the attributing causation in country programs is very, very difficult. And then donor collaboration. More and more, the means of delivering foreign aid is to come together, multiple donors, under a common umbrella of funding, whether it's the PRSC I mentioned, or what we call SWAP, sector-wide approaches, the Paris Declaration. And for that, how do you untangle one donor from another donor? Maybe you don't have to. Maybe it's contribution. But if you really want to be rigorous on attributing results to foreign assistance, this problem comes up all of the time. And I can't say we found the answer to it, but we struggle with it. Seven, drawing implications. We do try always at the end of our evaluations, to all of them, even the project evaluations, to generalize, get some lessons, and come up with recommendations. And that is truly an art. It's not an easy thing to do. First, you really have to understand the context to make a recommendation that's going to be meaningful. It's very easy to have general recommendations that everybody can just say, oh, yes, we agree, we're doing them, or things that are so specific that it's kind of tiny. It's like the choice of topic. It's not easy to pitch it right, to get the right meaningful recommendations that you can actually measure if they were implemented or not, but big enough so that you can literally have 3 or 4 or 5 instead of 25 out of one big evaluation. We are trying to, we every year we collect all the recommendations from our evaluations, and we have a document, we track it for 3 years. We go back to management, what have you done? The ones they've agreed with they're supposed to do, we track it for 3 years. I can't say we have this perfect, but we're working very hard to upgrade it, because our board is very concerned on the follow-on to IEG reports. Doesn't feel management really pays enough attention to them. So we're trying to up this, this area of our work. But it's not easy to pitch recommendations at the right level, so that they're meaningful, but you can tell if they've been acted upon or not. Eight, it goes without saying that objectivity and independence is really essential. I had never realized the importance of IEG independence until I came to IEG, partly because I never realized how hard it is to get outside of your milieu. We have an interesting trade-off, as I guess all evaluation offices do. How much should we hire from inside as opposed to outside? If you hire from inside, these people know the organization, like myself, and it's a very complicated organization, and knowing what the problems are, where the bodies are buried, who to turn to for information, it's really very important, and it's not easy for an outsider who's never been in the heart of the organization to ever learn this, frankly. You can be there 10 years, and it's not easy to learn if you're coming just into IEG. On the other hand, from my experience, it takes about a year for staff to lose almost to brainwashing that the organization is just really doing its best and doing a good job, and to be objective. It's really not easy. And until you step out of it, you don't realize what kind of politically correct pressure there was when you're in the organization. I mean, amazing. But we all think we're objective, but when you step out of it, you realize how hard it is to really be objective. Now, we do have a lot of rules. The Director General can never go back to the World Bank. When I leave, they're going to do that at the director level as well. You can never go back so that you're independent. You have to be recused from any evaluation of any activity that you were ever involved in, which is, of course, understandable. We have our own rules on promotions, our own policies to try to not have people we're evaluating have any influence over the career trajectories in IEG. There's a lot of rules around this, and it's really very, very important to preserve that independence and that objectivity. Even with all of this, if you tackle all of these hurdles, you have a well-defined topic, widely accepted transparent objectives, many sources of solid, mutually supporting evidence, you know, some kind of plausible attribution, good recommendations, and you put them all together in an independent, objective way, it's still very difficult to influence behavior. I'd like to say that's not true, but it is. We try to do two things, learning and accountability. We really are trying to balance all the time, the learning objective with the accountability objective. On learning, it's difficult for evaluees to accept negative feedback. In the long run, they'll all say this is good for the organization, and I think they truly believe it. But I can tell you in the short run, it's very tough for managers to accept critical evaluations. As I mentioned, our H&P, health and nutrition, was really very critical. We found, for example, only a quarter of health projects in Africa are achieving their objectives. That's a pretty bad finding, one of the worst findings we've found. Management didn't particularly appreciate this finding, so it's tough. Doing business, we also got a tremendous pushback. On the other hand, you know, my view is we have one job, and that's to be accurate. And you let the chips fall where they may, but you really have to be quality and you have to be accurate. On the accountability side, which is also a very important job we have, it does require effective governance of the organization to take results and push through change. You need to have strong corporate governance to take evaluation results and use them. We now have very, very detailed protocols that we've worked out on how we handle evaluations at all stages with management. We disclose everything. You'll see it on the website. The only things we don't disclose as of now are our project-level evaluations, and next year we're going to disclose all of those. Actually, the World Bank is moving toward an extremely liberal disclosure policy, which is basically everything will be disclosed except a specific list of items that will not. But everything else, the assumption is full disclosure. And IEG is going to do the same. So you'll be able to get all of these evaluations on our website. And already, all of the macro things and everything we disclose. I mentioned the IDA deputies because IDA is the window of the World Bank that is low interest loans, and it's funded by donors. And it's large, and every 3 years it's replenished by the donors. And the IDA deputies are the representatives of the developed countries who put this money in. They are very powerful. And in fact, I think perhaps our strongest governance comes from the IDA deputies. These are the ones who, like Australia, I'm sure, as an IDA deputy, is saying, we want the World Bank to be accountable. We want you to pay attention to IEG evaluations. I've been talking with some of the U.S. Congress committees, and they have these IEG evaluations underlined, and they obviously are paying a lot of attention. And they're going back to management saying, we want you to pay attention. This year, the IDA deputies are going to meet in November. Just before that, we will come out with our gender evaluation and our PRSC evaluation and another CPIA evaluation, things that are relevant for IDA. And I very much expect the IDA deputies will pay a lot of attention to that. That's the governance mechanism that we need to make these evaluations really have an impact, assuming everything else is high quality, which is really job number one. Finally, all of this, I don't want you to be pessimistic, because I'm actually very optimistic, and we have to keep optimistic. The movement for evaluation and for learning is growing, no question about it. And the process matters as much as the product. I actually, as I titled it messy, because I do think this is a messy business. It's complex, often very confusing. Causation is often unclear. Progress is uneven. It's messy, but it's extremely valuable. It's extremely interesting. It's very much appreciated. I think there are short-run tensions, including with people who don't like negative findings. But in the long run, even World Bank management, all the way up to the current president, says IEG is doing its job. We've got to listen. And they know deep down that this is really a very, very important part of everyone's work. This is accountability, and this is learning. And the last thing I will say is the focus on results is what I started with. And IEG's role in a long stream of focusing on results is more important than the evaluations themselves. In fact, I think the evaluation, monitoring evaluation process within the projects and the constant learning that's going on, which is furthered because IEG is going to be looking at this, is really where most of the learning takes place. It's not through impact evaluations that are nice published academic articles. It's through the day-to-day nitty-gritty of trying to monitor and learn from the day-to-day practice in these projects. We come at the tail end, we have a very important role, but it's really the whole span that I think is really very critical for development. So I will stop there. We have our website here, and I don't know what the time is, but I think we have a few minutes if I can take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Cheryl. We'll open the open questions to the audience. If you could go to the mic for your questions. Thanks, Paul. Perhaps you can just say who you are when you come to the mic.
Yes, hi, my name is Paul Dagnan. Thanks for that presentation. A few weeks ago, I was in Damascus at an evaluation clinic where there's myself as the only psychologist, and there were five economists talking as the evaluation experts, and three were from the World Bank. But one thing, which was an interesting experience in itself, but one thing I noticed was that the way the economists from the World Bank, just to generalize, thought about evaluation was mainly to think in terms of just impact evaluation. And when when we were talking through some projects, and when we ran into problems with the impact evaluation, the reaction was just to continue to try and figure out how to do an impact evaluation, even in an instance where maybe it was better to abandon in that. And in terms of, as evaluators, over the last several decades, we see evaluation as there being a range of possibilities. You try to do impact evaluation, but if you can't, then you may look at process evaluation, formative evaluation, and various mixes of evaluation strategies to deal with that sort of situation. And I was just wondering what the Independent Evaluation Office of the World Bank is doing to really build that kind of wider picture of evaluation capacity within the World Bank, so that, and it's not just restricted to the World Bank at all, it's really, I think, through a lot of different organisations, there's this idea that evaluation equals impact evaluation, which we all know is very important. But it seems to be perhaps a role for a bit of capacity building there around being more strategic about the utilisation of evaluation resources and thinking about other possibilities. I just wondered whether you wanted to comment. Thanks.
So I take that. You probably had a certain, there are camps, you know, just like in every other organisation, just like in evaluation. My guess is the three people at that were from the research part of the bank, or from, we have small groups that do impact evaluation in the HD network and in Africa. And there's this movement and a kind of a camp. It's not IEG, obviously. It's also not operations, where the mainline people working at the front line with clients would appreciate that, but I think they would see that it's not applicable in every situation. So. You know, I would very much agree with you that that's a very narrow view. It tends to be the view of a certain group. Now, what does IEG do? Actually, interestingly, even within research, there's a variety. We work quite a bit with research, and there are some very, very good people. Martin Revelyan's one of them, who I mentioned, who wouldn't say this. I mean, he's such a smart guy, he'd be very eclectic about what you need in what situation. And there are a number like that as well. Unfortunately, the exact person is probably, you know, you probably got a group who have that point of view. It's certainly not the only point of view in the bank. It's one point of view. It's important to do those impact evaluations. It's important to build them in, but as I've tried to make clear, it's certainly not the only way.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing, and it wasn't really any resistance to the idea of these other forms of evaluation. It was more, you know, they were interested. It wasn't so much so just insisting had to do impact evaluation. It was almost as though really just opening the horizons of possibilities, and they were kind of almost excited about that.
Right.
So that made me think it was capacity building rather than.
It's probably resistance. A good idea. A part of our capacity building is having staff. We're trying to get staff movement in and out of IEG. I actually think 2 years in IEG and then going back to operations is extremely valuable, the flow back and forth. And we're trying to get more of this kind of rotation. There are issues, you know, both on the positive and negative there. But IEG doesn't do a whole lot of training, partly because we are independent. And I mean, we do training on how to do project-level evaluations. We're always asked to come in and talk to staff about that.
Thanks very much.
We're going to be doing a meta-analysis of the bank's impact evaluations next year. Maybe we could pull some of this together. But I certainly understand your question, and there are some factions, all kinds of different camps in the bank that have different things, including the very rigorous impact evaluation RCT group. But it's fairly small, I think it's fair to say. So,
I know there are a number of people who want to ask questions in the audience, and just so I can be a little bit fair about it, can I ask you to sort of queue up behind the mic so that I, because otherwise it's a little bit difficult for me to. I know Ralph's there at the ready at the mic, but I want to make sure that some of you people down here are also ready. Ralph.
Good morning. Ralph Stratton, Murdoch University. Thank you very much for that. It was a really good list of challenges and very helpful. One of the things I think we as evaluation people are not very good at is doing empirical research on evaluation. And we just have ignored that right across the board and across the world to a large extent. And I'm wondering, to the extent to which the World Bank invests and conducts research, empirical research on evaluation, just a very small example of one of my graduate students from actually more than 20 years ago. He went to Mexico from Perth, being fluent in Spanish, and did a critical review, empirical review of eight development evaluations of development projects, and was a couple of the conclusions he came to was that people flying in for a little while and collecting a bit of data and disappearing back to whatever the donor country was, or the World Bank, or wherever, and also orienting the whole thing, which happened in all eight cases, to the donors, was not very well received by the local in-country people, who said, this information may be of use to them, we can't really see why, given what they actually gathered, but it was of no use to us in helping to continue and sustain and further development, develop these projects. So I'm interested in the extent to which you are involved in research, empirical research, on your own evaluation methods, in fact, the full scope of possibilities.
Right. I think we don't do a lot of the research on evaluation methods. It's a very good point. There is a lot of push to not to try to dovetail World Bank evaluation with the use of the country's own evaluation. And we found, for example, we just looked at 24 municipal development projects, and the ones that were really successful on the monitoring evaluation were the ones that used the same system that the city was using anyway. For example, in Tianjin, China, World Bank's project simply used the Tianjin monitoring evaluation and helped develop it. So it left something behind in terms of good evaluation capacity for the country as a whole. That's certainly the ideal, and the way we're trying very much, the World Bank and donors are trying to push to use country systems rather than set up, you know, specific donor-run monitoring evaluation systems. So I think that is very much on our minds, on the whole donor community's minds. Not there yet. We want to put a lot more investment into capacity building for monitoring and evaluation. One little thing that World Bank, many of you may know, IPDET, which is in Canada once a year, it's a one-month course. IEG founded that about 8 years ago, and so far we've trained 1,500 developing country evaluators through IPDET. And we're now going to try to expand that to regional centers in four regions to have them in the developing countries themselves. Programs of evaluation capacity development. Because I think your basic message, which is absolutely true, is to dovetail in, take only the data the World Bank needs and go out and use it for our own projects, really doesn't build any capacity and it doesn't have a very good long-term impact. I think people are very aware of that. Donors are very aware of that. But how you get your job done when you're being asked to do M&E, when the country system simply can't do it, that's the problem that people face on the ground in practice. So we have to work on the system development while you're also trying to do the short-term job. So we don't do research, but I think we do quite a bit of capacity development and need to do more, frankly.
That's very important. But really my main point was, let's all do empirical research on the methods of evaluation so we can choose better. We know what their characteristics are and we can choose better.
Yep. Good. Well, you're in academia. I'd highly recommend you do that.
Hi, my name is Sarah Webb. I'm an independent consultant working in aid and development. You mentioned an issue that I've struggled a lot with and many of my colleagues have, which of course is the question of attribution. And I'd just be interested to hear a little bit more about the things IEG has experimented with or explored to try and address that critical question.
It depends very much on the type of evaluation. Some are much easier than others, obviously, but the country evaluations are the hardest. Because I mentioned the Georgia example, but every country, separating out what actually the World Bank's effect was from what the country would have done anyway is really very tough. Going and talking to people and understanding the dynamics, looking at all the analytic work that was done, figuring out who's actually used this analytic work, if it influenced key policymakers, whether the loans and the conditions in the loans made a difference. A lot of interviewing, a lot of qualitative work to try to understand the nuances of the dynamics going on in the country. We put a lot of work into talking with the clients and trying to understand what the actual causal chain was. But it's not perfect. And I think we also say, you know, if we probably give up trying too hard. We say, if you have a good program you're supporting and it's leading to good outcomes, separating out whether the country would have done that anyway or whether it required bank involvement, you know, it's something we'd like to know, but it's probably not the most important thing. The most important thing is, was it implemented and did it lead to good outcomes? And did the World Bank contribute? I think contribution, it's not a perfect evaluation, but we often say, is there a clear causal chain of contribution? Because it's almost impossible to sort out the attribution perfectly. It's really not, you know, I can't say we've solved it. I don't think we ever will, given this type of evaluation. This is true, of course, with the sectors as well. Projects, it's significantly easier because you tend to be able to see the counterfactual a little bit more. It's still not perfect, though. We're all talking about shades of gray. I can't say we've solved it, but I think a lot of it is understanding the context and talking. Really, the qualitative side of evaluation comes into play a lot here. That's why one problem with RCTs, they're great in certain circumstances, but you don't get inside the box of the causal box of why you're getting these results. You really need to go in and understand the context and talk to people. We try our best to do that, but you know, it's not perfect. Okay.
Thanks. My name's Glenn Bond. I'm Program Effectiveness Manager for PLAN International in Australia, an NGO. There are striking parallels for every one of your slides between your experience at a World Bank IEG level around evaluation. And every step of the way, striking parallels for us.
Good.
So very useful and insightful to hear it coming from your level. The striking difference, if you will, it was scale. We think about certainly for other NGOs in the room, but for other organisations as well, the scale of the issues you've flagged there and the connection at the highest level around attribution and contribution and connections to Paris Declaration, but even around independence and biased management of evaluations. The question for us, I heard figures like 60 billion and 50 billion and indeed the smallest reference to an evaluation where you spent $200,000 on the Peru example where it's so far removed in some respect from the scale that we manage things, even on a global level for NGOs, that I wonder what if any reflections you have for these same challenges in smaller organisations where we don't have those same resources necessarily, but that we have the same intent. And parallel to that, whether you think there's a role for independent groups such as your own within NGO environments.
And last question, you mean the IEG and NGOs, our relation, or
well,
listening
to you speak, sorry, that was a separate question, but listening to you speak, I wondered whether within PLAN, within other NGOs as federations and alliances, whether that sort of independent evaluation group had legs as an idea, whether as a parallel separately reporting, and whether that would be a way of resourcing and getting some of that independence that we probably lack in evaluations.
Yeah. Well, I am a strong believer on the independent side, and I know in the bilaterals this is a big issue, and some of the bilaterals like DFID are pushing more towards, actually there's two different strands going on at the same time. Part of it is pushing toward more independence for the evaluation function. Another part, which may win actually under the new, if Cameron comes in as I understand, is taking away evaluation altogether from DFID and putting it in a separate part of government. And actually in the U.S., it's interesting, the new Foreign Assistance Act is providing for basically an IEG equivalent for all foreign aid in the United States, a separate independent evaluation group. Now, we have the General Accounting Office, or now General Accountability Office, but they're very far removed from foreign assistance. So the new plan in the U.S. they're talking about is a special and yet independent group for foreign assistance. It's very hard where you situate these. If it's too far removed, you won't have the inside information that you really need to know what's going on. If it's right within the organization reporting to management, it's really very hard to say anything that's independent. So I think finding that where you situate it, so it's close enough and yet far enough, is really the art. But I think that model really is very important. In terms of the scale, I don't have much to say except every scale of work is valuable. I mean, I think it's very valuable to evaluate a program of 12 people on drug rehabilitation, extremely important. I mean, for those people's lives and for other people who would use that, doing it well. I think the key is don't overreach. If you don't have the money to do a huge thing, then do a smaller thing, but do it well. because I think every scale of evaluation has a lot to offer. We happen to do some things in a big scale because World Bank is doing a lot and hopefully is doing a lot of good and not a lot of harm. But I think every scale, even our projects, you know, I didn't mention it, but our M&E work in small projects would be much smaller amounts of money. The self-evaluations may be $20,000, $25,000, building it in from the beginning. So I think even in the World Bank, you'll see things at different scales. But there's room at every single scale, I think, for good evaluation. I think the key is don't pick things that are too big to do with the amount of resources that are available.
Last question. Thank you.
Good morning, Cheryl. My name's Andrew Pope. I'm the director of the Office of Evaluation and Audit for Indigenous Programs. We're similar, but a lot smaller than the IEG in the sense that we are independent. We sit in the Department of Finance and observe everyone else's programs. And a lot of the slides you put up, I think, resonate very strongly with the sort of peculiarities of an independent arrangement. My question was really about influence and how you saw particular issues about how you influence programs. And really it goes to, do you see the work of the IEG as more focused in influencing lending decisions or policy decisions about what you should be doing? Or do you see it going toward improving the implementation of existing programs and projects? And if so, is it a pragmatic decision or a strategic one that you've chosen?
Okay. All of the above. I mean, if you look at our health nutrition population, part of what we're doing is trying to influence the strategy. Gender. I mean, you'll see when that comes out. I'm very proud of this one because I think it's a really important topic, and it's going to be quite a powerful evaluation because it really shows some difficult problems. But we're partly, did the World Bank set the right strategy? Was it a clear strategy? Did it change over the years? Did it change purposefully, or did it change just from neglect? Was it a realistic strategy? Then how was it implemented? And we try to sort out, what, if it didn't go well, was it because the strategy was wrong or because the implementation was wrong? And you know, sometimes we'll find the strategy was wrong, but often, generally, we'll find the implementation fell short of what was said. A lot of our job is, did the World Bank do what it says it was going to do? That's a lot of what we do. And in many cases, they said something very nice in the strategy and it didn't follow through on the implementation. And we're there to point this out. It's often quite embarrassing, frankly, but sometimes it jumps out at you. So I think, you know, it just depends. But part of it's strategy, part of it is implementation. And each evaluation, you know, will have a different mix of those things. Part of it is corporate. We also do corporate evaluations. We're going to be evaluating this year our matrix management structure and how it's working to create incentives at the staff level. We're going to evaluate how we manage trust funds. It sounds like a boring topic, but it's so much money that getting deep in how the world may manage trust funds is something. We just evaluated the internal controls over IDA, and we found a material weakness, if you know that language in accounting, in the controls over fraud and corruption. And this, of course, is also going to play. Not that they're not trying, and in fact, finding that material weakness, management has really bent over backwards over the last year to increase its attention within projects for fraud and corruption. Not that they weren't doing it before, they've been doing this for 10 years. But so some of it is at the corporate level, some of it is at the strategic level in sectors, some of it is at the implementation level. It really just, the nice thing is nothing is off limits. If it affects development effectiveness, IEG can do it. There have been one or two cases where management pushed back and said, that's outside of your mandate. And the board very strongly came back and said, no, it's not. Go ahead. And we're going ahead. So I don't think management wants to fight that battle. This is what comes with independence. And really, really very valuable, I think. So I have to be proud of the World Bank for allowing this. You know, this is something to say. It's not easy to have IEG constantly on your case. And I think it's a good model. All of the MDBs, you know, have followed this model and are trying to do similar things. I think it's a good model, but it's not an easy model for management. Sometimes management says, why are we putting up with this? You know, how many corporations would have a group that openly goes to the press? We've been on the front page of the New York Times with our criticisms several times over the last year. How many corporations would allow inside group that they pay their salaries to embarrass them this way? So
I know the feeling. Thanks.
I have to hand it to the organization, but anyway.
Thanks, Cheryl. Well, you're certainly somebody who's been walking the talk in being so open with us this morning about your analysis there. And you mentioned early on in your address about the difficulties that you have when people have been connected with programs for too long and they become advocates of them. And so I think IEG's been very lucky to have you come in there as a fresh eye and over the last 2 years to do this fabulous reflection on their processes and to be able to move them forward. We'll see how you go in 10 years' time. We might come back. You may be totally entrenched in it by then.
Right. Okay.
But please join me in thanking you. Domestics?
They're called domestics now instead of housekeeping. There's a couple of, three announcements actually. Would the staff of the Centre for Programme Evaluation at the University of Melbourne would be pleased to meet with current and past students in the Swan Room at lunchtime today. Lunch will be served in that area, so you can just grab your lunch and go in there. There's a meeting of fellows in the executive room, which is just the room over here to my left. That's at 12:45. And there's another meeting. It's actually for anyone who would like to be involved in progressing the AAS Indigenous Strategy Interest Group. This is today at lunchtime, and it's in the downstairs seating area in front of the windows by reception. And it's suggested that you grab your lunch up here and then go downstairs. One final remark is that for those people who are delegates today, you'll find in your satchel an evaluation form. And, in the spirit of an evaluation society that likes to assess whether or not the conference has gone well, we'd really encourage people to fill in those forms. And if you're only here today, to deposit them at the reception desk. So thank you very much.